Good morning and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. If this is one of your first times here, I encourage you to come more than one time because Prairie Sunday morning services are always different. Sometimes I do them. I am Sandy Ingham. I am Prairie's minister. Sometimes people from within our congregation do the service, and sometimes people from outside come in and do the service. Prairie aspires to be both open-minded and open-hearted. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, family structure, no matter what your disabilities or your abilities or inabilities are, no matter your age, we welcome you. The opening words were written by Universalist Minister Hosea Ballou. I'll have more to say about Hosea in a little bit. If we agree in love, there is no disagreement that can do us any injury. But if we do not, no other agreement can do us any good. Let us endeavor to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bonds of peace. Holly, would you, or Faith, do you want to light the chalice? May this light kindle within us the warmth of compassion, the glow of love, the fire of commitment, and the light of truth. Now I invite anyone who wants to come up for the story. This story combines two of my loves, baseball and history. This is a true story, and I would almost bet money that no one in this room has ever heard of this person. Lizzie Murphy, who was the first woman to play on both Major League All-Star teams. See, I was going to play Major League Baseball. Shortstop for the Pirates. But I got a little off my career path. In 1900, that was a very long time ago, even I was not alive then, baseball was America's favorite game, and every boy owned a glove, a bat, and a ball, and a dream that he would be in professional major leagues. Well, our story takes place in a town called Warren, Rhode Island. There were a lot of teams in this town. You guys okay over there? Okay? Hey, you guys okay? Okay, baseball story, pay attention. Very important. Yes. Baseball story. There were a lot of teams in this town, and Lizzie Murphy's dad had played on one of them, and now, when the story takes place, her brother is on a team. And even when Lizzie was 6 years old, she could really catch and throw that ball because her brother practiced with her for long, long days. Her dad said, "Lizzie, you are really good." Lizzie said, "I want to play first base like you did, Dad." She's good, her brother Henry said. "Don't encourage her," their mother said. "Girls don't play baseball." "Well," said her dad, "she's really good." So when she was 8 years old, she used to go to all of Henry's games, she asked the captain of Henry's team, his name was Eddie, if she could be on the team. Well, what do you think he said? No. In fact, he laughed at her. "Girls don't play baseball." But she didn't give up. "Please, please, please," she begged. "No." "Well, can I at least carry the bat?" "Okay," Eddie said. One day they went off to play another team, and neither team had brought a ball. But Lizzie had a ball. She showed it to Eddie. "Give it to me." "Okay, if I can play first base." All right. They let her play. So there she is. She has her dad's glove. Apparently. Ah, she carried it everywhere she went. And She gets ready at first base. Her brother's playing shortstop. She was pretty nervous. You might imagine that she was kind of nervous. First batter up hit a ball to her brother. And her brother, of course, threw it to her at first base. No problem. It was just like when they practiced in the backyard. Well, Lizzie went on to hit a single, a triple, and a double in that game. And then she struck out her last time up, but that was all right because the team was ahead 10 to nothing by then. Lizzie, you really can play. Okay, you can be on the team, Eddie said. Hooray for Lizzie. In the winter, when she was 12, she had to go to work in the textile factory. Some of you might know what that is, but they made cloth there. And she had a lot of time to daydream. So she daydreamed about playing baseball, of course. She practiced her violin during the winter months. She skated. She was really good at ice hockey. She was also a really good swimmer. She was just a very good athlete. When she was 15 years old, she was actually a regular on two teams. Now, they were just amateur teams, which means they didn't get paid for playing. And one of them was called the Silk Hats, and the other one was called the Warren Baseball Club. She played any position. She played anywhere they needed her to play. Well, 3 years later, when she was 18, her mother said, "It's time for us to have a talk." What? She knew what was coming. "You're a grown-up lady now, Lizzie. You can't play baseball any longer. You can't get paid for it. You mean I should give it up?" "Well, yes, because a woman can't support herself playing baseball. Men hardly can." Well, she didn't want to do that. So she thought about it. She actually went to a couple of games where she did not play, but she sat in the stands with everybody else. But one time she almost ran down on the field when the third baseman dropped a really easy ball. So she thought, "I can't give this up." So she kept looking around and she found a professional team to hire her. And the professional teams paid money. So she went running in. It was in the papers. It was a big deal because the manager thought, "I'm going to make a lot of money by this kind of freak thing here." Well, the mother said, "But you can't do this. You'll never get married." She said, "I don't care. I'll play baseball." So she got there. Oh, and I forgot to tell you that one day when she was 10, she was playing the other team. It was that first game she played. The other team started making smart-aleck remarks and saying, "Go back to your knitting. Girls can't play. What are you doing out here?" But that obviously did not stop her. So she gets there in her first game as a professional. And there were all these people there. I mean, there wasn't a seat anywhere. She said, "What's going on?" And of course, the owner said, "Well, I knew people would come in to see a girl play." Well, she was nervous. She was really nervous again, but she did so well. Her fielding was perfect. She got a hit. She did strike out once, but she got a triple. And her team won 10-2. Well, in those days, the manager came around right after the game was over and paid the players. But he walked right by Lizzie. He didn't give her anything. She was angry. But she had a plan. She worked really hard all week. And when the next weekend came and they were supposed to get on a bus to go play a team in another city, she waited till everyone was on, and then she just stood there. And the manager said, "Lizzie, get on the bus. We're going to be late. Then you have to pay me first." "I'm not paying, Lizzie. You'll just get married and leave the team. This is my job. I am not getting on the bus." The manager said, "Lizzie, people are coming just to see you." And she said, "Yes. That's my point." I don't know if that's exactly what she said. But the guys in the bus, all the young men in the bus were saying, go Lizzie, you pay her." And he did. The manager did pay her. And her mother even decided maybe this wasn't too bad of a thing. She got her a jersey with Lizzie's name on the front and the back to wear. For the next 17 years, she played professional baseball. And she always made sure she got paid. And her fans called her the Queen of Baseball. So there you go.
Farewell, good friends, farewell, good friends,
Just a postscript, because it's such a good story. She eventually had herself, Lizzie did, listed in the telephone book as Lizzie Murphy, ball player. She won a contract with the Boston All-Stars. The manager said she's worth every cent. She made, you know, as much money as the man, which wasn't very much, but she brought in sometimes $50 a game. She was the first woman to play in a Major League exhibition game and the first person to play on the National and the American League's All-Star teams. In one exhibition game, she faced Satchel Paige, the great black pitcher, and he didn't let, you know, he didn't think, oh, this is a girl, this is a woman. He, as this author says, bore down with everything he had, and she hit a single. I was especially kind of almost given goosebumps when I read the sources for this story. The first source listed is Gay Ingham, spelled the way I spell my name. All right, enough of all that. This is a reading by Barbara Rohde, who is not a UU minister, but a very talented UU lay leader. Written a wonderful book of essays. She titles this one, The Ideas That Have Moved Us. We can catch glimpses of who we are by looking at our historical past, as a denomination and as a fellowship. To know who we are, we must know where we came from and which ideas moved us. The nature of Unitarian Universalism is constantly changing, and we have no creed. Yet certain ideas have existed throughout our history. We have always believed that the source of religious authority does not reside in the Pope or the minister or in a book, but within the center of our own personalities, within our deepest selves. That idea has often been corrupted to suggest that all expressions of belief are equally valid. We have always believed in freedom of thought and the expression of thought. That idea has been corrupted so that it often seems to be saying, "Leave me alone," rather than, "Tell me what you see." We have always been advocates of religious tolerance, but that belief has changed from saying, "I won't burn you at the stake," to saying, "I won't let you know I disagree with you." In the great religious division between those who would exclude in order to purify and those who would embrace in order to redeem, we have always been with the embracers. We have no creedal requirements for membership, unless your last name is Creed, which is how it should be. But that does not mean we should not be passionate about our search for truth, nor that membership has no meaning. Universal design, as I understand it, and as I said in the current newsletter, is a design response that fits for all, not for most. Does that make sense? Design responses that fit for all, not for most, even though they might have been designed just for a few people. And I gave an example of curb cutouts for wheelchairs or scooters or things like that. But we all use those. We all use the curb cutouts. So I did a little play on words there and thought it might be kind of the same way with that second U in our
difficult to say, name Unitarian Universalists. And, you know, we tend to leave out the Universalist word all the time, which drives me a little crazy. Designed or conceived of with a specific set of people in mind, I'm talking about Universalism now, those would have been the specific set of people who did not believe in eternal damnation in the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s. But the word eventually came to be seen by its adherents and others as a religion that just might be a good fit for all people, as in its name, Universalism. That opening hymn speaks to that belief. Down the ages we have trod many paths in search of God. And I really, of course, like that hymn because I chose it. But all the different ways to believe in God, to define God, to search for God. Universalist design is dependent upon those ideas that have moved us, us being our spiritual ancestors in general, and the Universalist ones in particular. As I've said on other Sundays, there were many people who are a part of that great cloud of witnesses that surrounds us. Many were Unitarians, but today's service is made possible because of the lives of the Universalists who have gone before us, showing us a path, a way to bring more light into the world. And I'm very happy to see the two people here whom I know were raised Universalists. So, why do we tell their stories? Well, because, as I said in mid-January, it is always a good thing to tell and retell the stories of those who have gone before us and have fought for peace and justice and equality and have tried to live lives of integrity. Martin Luther King Jr. said at one of the first Ware lectures at our annual General Assembly, and you'll find this quote, if you want to read it silently while I read it, at the top of your order of service. "My friends, there are some things in our nation and in our world to which I'm proud to be maladjusted, and I call upon you to be maladjusted, and all people of goodwill to be maladjusted to these things until the good society is realized." End of quote. Being maladjusted is something to be proud of. And knowing the stories about those from our tradition and our heritage who were also maladjusted gives us hope. We started at the January service when I began this sort of series with a man named Georges de Benville. You might remember, those of you who were here, he survived beheading at the very last moment. He had a reprieve from the king because his family was connected to the royal family. I always remember Georges de Benville because he was the youngest of 9 children. Some of you will remember I said this before. His mother had 4 sets of twins in 4 years. Then Georges was born. Then his mother died. I mean, it's not funny, but it is kind of funny. So we call, that's the only review I'm going to do of Georges de Benville at the moment, but fascinating. All these people are fascinating. All these lives are fascinating. So we call de Benville the first preacher of Universalism in America, in this country. We call his contemporary, John Murray, the father of Universalism in this country. In his book, These Live Tomorrow, Universalist minister Clinton Lee Scott opens his chapter on John Murray with this story. Murray was preaching one Sunday morning, and suddenly a rock was thrown through the church window, barely missed his head. He picked it up and he said, "This argument is solid and weighty, but it is neither reasonable nor convincing." He put the rock aside and he said, "Not all the stones in Boston, except they stop my breath, shall shut my mouth. This because he was preaching universalism. Now, I should briefly mention here the Ballou family. There were a lot of them, and they were they produced a lot of ministers, preachers, and especially a lot of universalist ones. Hosea Ballou, I hope some of you have heard of Hosea. He's the most famous of that family. He's been called the single most important leader in universalist history. And even if you only have a passing knowledge of that history, you probably have heard of him. He couldn't read until he was in his late teens. He never went to school. He came from a very poor farming family, although probably not that all that different from several, you know, from a lot of families then. But he had to work. He had to work on the farm. He taught himself to read, and when he was 18, 19, and 20. But then there wasn't much to read. You know, there was the Bible. And the Bible contradicted what his father was preaching. One day his father said, "What are you reading?" Hosea said, "A universalist book." Well, his father was, a good father, but very strict about religion and the Baptist faith. His father said, "Well, I can't allow that. Get it out of this house." Hosea went out, and he knew his dad was watching him, so he hid this book in the woodpile because he knew his father would go and find the book, right? Well, of course, it was the Bible. Hosea Ballou was a minister in Boston for 30 years. 1,000 people came, not just for one service on Sunday, for all these 30 years, for three services on Sunday. 1,000 people at each of those services. A distant cousin of Hosea's was Aidan Ballou, and when we get to the final hymn, you'll see that he wrote the words, Aidan did, for that hymn. Well, Aidan started out being a disciple of Christ and very, very strict Calvinist beliefs because he had been converted at a big revival after a huge storm went through, where did they live? New Hampshire, and destroyed a lot of things. So then this revival movement came out, and the storm went through because the people were living in sin and all of those things. So Aidan became a minister for the Disciples of Christ, but the more he tried to refute his distant cousin Hosea's beliefs, the more he started believing them. It was a little difficult to argue against them when you're actually beginning to believe them. Finally, as John Robinson says in a book about Unitarian Universalists, Aidan Ballou surrendered to the irresistible appeal that universalism made to his rational mind. And I find that fascinating because we often make this sweeping generalization that Unitarians are always the rational ones in their head, and universalists were from the heart and from the gut. Aidan Ballou is, we could maybe try to remember him, although if there's a quiz, it will be open book. He was a pacifist, and a very vocal pacifist, but he also was a socialist or communist, small letter C, because he was one of those people in the 1800s who believed that the ideal Christian community was exactly that, a commune type arrangement, a way of living, a utopian community. And you may have heard of Hopedale. Aidan Ballou founded Hopedale. In January, I briefly mentioned how mysticism and spiritualism were intertwined with the universalist movement. Someday we'll have to do maybe a whole service on this because it's fascinating that the mysticism worked in here. To me, this is logical. If you're talking about universal love and one universal church based on love, you know, one big umbrella one, but under which everybody would be able to keep their whatever their own beliefs were, that gets into a mystical realm, I think. Spiritualism enters the picture here because I don't know why. John Buren, any of you know that name? I'm going to refer to John Buren's in a few minutes too. because I couldn't believe something he did not do in a book I was of his that I was using as a reference. John didn't say this, but some current Unitarian Universalist minister said that the challenge of spiritualism proved much more damaging to the Universalists than the Transcendentalist uprising did to the Unitarians. Now, if you know your history, you know that the Unitarians very successfully absorbed Unitarian or Transcendentalism. But spiritualism was thought of as odd. I guess we still think of it as odd. But there were many Universalists in the early and mid-1800s who became spiritualists, and a lot of the ministers did. Of course, it's not biblically based, and the Universalists were always more interested in having their ministers and their lay people recite creeds, and the ministers had to sign off on a creed. You didn't find that in Unitarianism. A Universalist minister, John Bovee Dodds, was asked to leave the ministry in this time period because he was into spiritualism, which wasn't biblically based. In part one, I mentioned Lydia Ann Moulton Jenkins. As we don't know much about the women in this period of time, and of course there weren't very many women who were ministers. There certainly were a number of Universalist and Unitarian ministers who were very active in the social justice movement, in the settlement houses, and trying to get the right to vote for women, in anti-slavery movement. And I mentioned that Lydia Jenkins was really the first woman to be ordained in 1860 by a Universalist congregation, but it wasn't Olympia Brown. She was the second one. Olympia Brown applied to the Unitarian Theological College in Meadville, Pennsylvania. Well, anytime we talk about that theological school, it catches my attention because I grew up about 18 miles from Meadville, Pennsylvania. Olympia Brown's application was turned down by the admissions people because, quote, they thought it too great an experiment. Next, she applied to Oberlin College, and they said she could go to Oberlin, but only if all the time she was there studying, she refrained from speaking publicly. Eventually, she applied to St. Lawrence College in Canton, New York, and she was admitted there with no catch. As to her eventually becoming a minister, which was her goal, that was something that St. Lawrence University believed was between you and the great head of the church. This is the time period when the Universalist General Reform Association was founded in the 1840s in New England. And I mentioned it last time in January, you had to pay 50 cents for the dues a year, but anybody could belong. They had 40 goals in four categories. The categories included slavery, women's rights, anti-war, non-resistance, Indian affairs, social institutions and habits, prison reform, and rehabilitation, and end to the death penalty. Pretty ambitious for any time period, wouldn't you say? And these stories make me hopeful, kind of. On the other hand, they make me impatient. So I'm practice my learning more about patience when I read these stories. I'm going to get us into the 20th century now with Mary Ashton Rice Livermore. I think I said in January that the women of this time period generally had four names, but we'll just call her Mary for our purposes right now. Clara Barton's in this same time period, but you probably know a lot about Clara, so we won't go into that. Mary Livermore wrote this when she was almost 85 years old. False early conceptions darkened my childhood and youth. This faith in Universalism during the years that I have believed it has grown upon me until it is the central thing in me. I do not engage in anything that is not, as I see it, the outcome of this faith. My later comprehension has given me a noble and abiding faith in human destiny, and I am happy to say I may still lend a hand to the weak and the struggling, or strike a blow for the right against the wrong. And to really appreciate that quote that she wrote when she was almost 85, you have to know a little something about her upbringing. It was a very strict Baptist upbringing. She spent a lot of her childhood fighting nightmares because she was sure she was not one of the saved. And she would wake her parents up and say, "We have to do something," in the middle of the night, and they'd go back to sleep, I think was their reaction. From this upbringing, Mary Livermore went on to marry a Universalist minister and an ardent abolitionist, David Livermore. He fully supported his wife and vice versa. Mary Livermore, despite being female, became one of the most sought-after speakers in the United States, even into her 80s. These women, of course, were also feminist supporters of equal rights for women, and they were especially passionate about getting the vote for women. Well, here is an interesting side note about Horace Greeley, who it turns out wasn't always a nice person. His paper, the New York Tribune, did cover the first women's rights convention held in Seneca Falls, New York in 1848, though the paper did not cover it very enthusiastically. Greeley wrote, "The best women I know do not wish to vote." So I'm reading this story and about Greeley and John Burens. John Burens, former president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, still a UU minister in San Francisco, I'm pretty sure. So Burens writing this piece, and I'm enjoying it. It's, you know, from our Universalist history. And not once did John Burens mention Horace Greeley's wife's name. This book was published in 2011. Come on, John. Her name was Mary Young Cheney. Yes, spelled that way. Greeley. I don't know. I didn't have time to go any farther into her history, so I don't know if she's related to Dick Cheney. Anyway, probably not. Horace and Mary Greeley's marriage was quite unhappy. He kept her constantly pregnant. Five of their children died young, and at least some of them from neglect. So I'm not sure what was going on there. Mary was a spiritualist. Mary Livermore, let's go back to Mary Livermore just for a moment, was called the Queen of the Platform because she was such a popular lecturer. I'm just going to give you a couple of titles from her, of her lectures. Concerning Husbands and Wives, which was about being equal partners in marriage. I'm talking 1850s, 60s, 70s. The Battle of Life, which was about working for a fair and just world, or she put it, the world that should be. Does the liquor traffic pay? And then What Shall We Do with Our Daughters? Which was about educating women for new roles in society. When Mary Livermore was 13, a teacher told her that she could not possibly have written the composition she gave him. It was way too good. Well, of course, she did write it. Mary Livermore proposed, planned, and managed the two great Chicago fairs. She took in almost a million, well, she didn't, but the fairs took in almost $1 million, which went to a pet project of hers, the United States Sanitary Commission. Abraham Lincoln was a friend of Mary Livermore's. He gave her the original manuscript of the Emancipation Proclamation, which she promptly sold at auction. Well, I don't know, promptly, but she sold it at auction for $300,000. She founded the Association for the Advancement of Women, and she was president of the American Woman Suffrage Association. Now, it is sometimes difficult to live up to our values. We all know that. And in this case, to our Universalist values. George Pullman. George Pullman was a very influential Universalist. He was a lay leader. He did a lot in his congregation. He had, I believe, two brothers who were Universalist ministers. Well, you probably have heard of George Pullman, who was wealthy. He had established that company town in Pullman, Illinois, and the workers went on strike because of the financial panic of 1893. Eugene Debs of the American Railway Union said they were going to boycott any handling of Pullman cars, which the workers did. President Grover Cleveland called in 12,000 army troops. 12 strikers were eventually killed. There was a lot of property damage. And according to John Burens, by the time George died in 1897, he was so unpopular with the workers, that he had to be buried in a lead-lined coffin in a reinforced steel concrete vault to prevent more violence against him on the other side of death. Clarence Russell Skinner, some of you may have heard of. One of his first positions was as assistant to the minister. Skinner didn't die until 1949, so we're getting into the middle part of the 1900s. He was an assistant to the minister of Universalist Congregation in New York City, where we now know that congregation as Fourth Universalist. But then the name of it was Church of the Divine Paternity, which I find rather interesting. It was Virgin Mary, but I didn't know about the divine paternity part. In 1910, Skinner went to Grace Universalist in Lowell, Massachusetts, where he started something called the Lowell Forum, a series of lectures about social issues. His church doubled in size. He asked, "How do we transform this old earth into the kingdom of heaven right now on earth?" And he said he believed that that was the primal question, in his words, of Universalists, and it should be of any church. He went on, "Universalism has not abolished the idea of hell. It has humanized and socialized it." Skinner continued, "If Universalism has established human misery as a direct consequence of human action, then a person must work out his or her own salvation. He or she must work out the salvation of the world." I think he's trying to say that hell is here on earth for so many people. I think he's trying to say a lot of other things too. In 1917, note that date, Skinner drafted a Declaration of Social Principles to be adopted at what was then called the Universalist General Convention, which has become part of General Assembly, of course. Here's his first point. "An economic order which shall give to every human being an equal share in the common gifts of God, and in addition, all that he shall earn by his own labor." Sounds like communism to me. Small letter, see? I'm quite fond of Clarence Skinner. His second point, "There should be a social order in which there shall be equal rights for all." This is 1917. "Special privileges for none, the help of the strong for the weak, and the weak until the weak become strong." I'm impressed.
Skinner, the psychologist?
No, but I think he was related to him. I'm impressed and humbled by this man, and again, trying to learn patience in matters of social justice. Skinner was a pacifist in World War I. Some of his colleagues, Universalists, shunned him for this. Was he a pacifist or was he a real Bolshevik, was the question asked. He spoke out publicly in defense of the IWW, the International Workers of the World, and he did call the American Legion anarchists. Skinner was a part-time minister near Tufts University when a Universalist congregation, when all this was going on. That church asked him to leave. The minister who succeeded Skinner, you definitely don't have to remember his name, even though he was a Universalist, welcomed the Ku Klux Klan to an evening service. Well, unfortunately, the Klan members came robed and hooded. Apparently, during this time period, the early 1900s, this was not necessarily unusual to have Klansmen sitting in your congregation, though I suspect the robed and hooded part was unusual. All right, before I end, I want to briefly mention two more Universalists who were important in the second half of the 1900s. Owen Young. I doubt many of you, I had not heard of Owen Young. He was a lawyer, an industrialist, and a statesman. He had a key role in renegotiating what Germany owed the Allies after World War I. Owen was on the board of General Electric. He founded RCA and NBC. What amazes me about Young was not that he favored heavy taxes on inherited wealth, which he did, but that he advocated for a time when labor would hire capital, not the other way around, and when workers would receive all the profits above the fair cost of the capital that they hired. He presented this idea once in a speech at the Harvard Business School in 1927 and received polite applause, though no one seemed to know what he was talking about. He was in favor of Social Security, unemployment insurance, disability insurance, none of which the General Electric Board was thrilled about. And the last name that I'll mention is one that some of you might know, Kenneth Patton. He lived from 1911 to 1994. He was minister at First Unitarian Society here in Madison before Max Gabler was the minister. Patton was at First from 1942 to 1948. He was too liberal and too radical for Madison. Here's something about Patton that I didn't know. He mentioned casually in a radio sermon that he would like to resign from the white race and become a colored man. Well, a national magazine picked up on this and on Patton's attempts to document how pervasive race prejudice was. Patton spent time in Chicago trying to integrate restaurants, country clubs, hotels, real estate. Shouldn't have been way ahead of his time then, but in some ways he was. He was extremely creative and artistic. When he eventually went to be minister at Charles Street Meeting House in Boston, Patton had 65 brass religious symbols from all over the world, from spiritual and religious traditions, installed. Not everybody on the board at Charles Street Meeting House in Boston was happy about this. And after Patton retired, he was minister there from 1949 until 1964, those symbols were moved to Starr King School for the Ministry, which is my alma mater. As I said in January, the Unitarians and the Universalists merged in 1961, and the major concern and the fear of the Universalists was justified. The Universalists were afraid they'd be swallowed up by the Unitarians. One of the ongoing impediments to the merger was the different opinions on creeds. Universalists were in favor of them generally, Unitarians not. I'm going to end with this quote that I used in January from Paul Carnes, who was a minister in Boston, and that was one of the few this was at the time of merger in the early 1960s, one of the few congregations where both the Unitarians and the Universalists were affiliated with that Buffalo church. Carnes said, something happened to the Universalists. They met the Unitarians, and they found that the Unitarians are more or less just like the Universalists, except that there are more of them, and they make more noise. The closing words, I'm repeating Hosea Ballou's. If we agree in love, there is no disagreement that can do us any injury. But if we do not, no other agreement can do us any good. Let us endeavor then to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bonds of peace. Greet your neighbor, stay for soup, and get outside. Right? My plan.